Welcome to Rolling Start. I'm Justin Nukasi, and I am the founder of this fascinating and inspiring series. We speak to successful business leaders from all walks of life who tell us about their professional and personal journey so far, including some of the tough barriers they've had to break through in order to get there. In this episode, fellow host Darren Johnson speaks to Nathan Ellington, a former professional footballer who, despite a successful playing career, tells us why life after football wasn't so rosy.
Thank you for joining Rolling Start today. I'm your host, Darren Johnson. I've got today for you an absolute legend, a person you may know. His name is Nathan Fontaine Ellington, better known as Nathan Ellington or the Duke. Today, we're going to be discussing his life, where he is now, where he has been, what he's been through to get to where he is today. And I hope it's going to be a good discussion. So welcome, Nathan.
Thank you.
So when did you actually start seeing success? So when did you realize you're successful? People started knowing your name. When was that? What part in your career?
Obviously, once I came through being the record signing from non-league, I didn't even realize it at the time. But that must have been a big thing from there. But it wasn't until I got my chance to play first team at Bristol Rovers and become a starter every week. And that's when really I kicked on. And the first season, I was top scorer at the club with like 23 goals. But we got relegated that same season. We had a lot of change, a lot of manager changes, a lot of player changes, and we just didn't manage to stay up. So we went down to Division 3, which is now called League 2. And then Jerry Francis took over. And I think the time when really everything changed was I was scoring every week. And in the month of December, I scored a hat-trick against Leighton Orient at home. Then we played against Swansea at home. I scored a hat-trick against them. And we played Derby, who were in the Premiership at the time. And they had Ravanelli, who I used to grow up watching on Italian football on Channel 4. And, you know, we played them in the FA Cup. I scored a hat-trick against them, all in the month of December. So imagine 9 goals, 3 hat-tricks, and everyone was talking about me at this point. Once we're the first team from the lowest level of league football to beat a Premiership side in the FA Cup. So it meant a lot to me. It was a great day out. And that's when I think my arrival on the scene was really stamped.
So eventually you find your way to Wigan. You prove that you're a star. You become a legend of that club. You play there and then you leave.
To be fair, I would have stayed at Wigan if I could, because I knew we had something special there. When I first went there, I looked at the players and I was like, wow, so many like captains all over the pitch, so many good players in every position. When I used to play with them, I was like, I was top scorer for them every season. But when I was injured and I would be watching from the sides, from upstairs and from the stands, I'd be looking at them in awe, like, wow, you guys play such great football. How? It's a weird one, because I'd say, you know, like on one hand, I say I'm really confident and I think I'm this good and that good. But when I was watching them, I was thinking, wow, these guys play some amazing football. You know, I wish I could play like that, but I'm actually part of their team. So it was a weird one. But anyway, I would have loved to have stayed, because we had something special going on there. We won games against the Premiership sides every season. So we showed we can hold our own, even when we was in Division 2, which was League 1 at the time. We were still beating Premiership sides and I was scoring. Then when we went to the Championship, obviously we won Division 2. We won it with over 100 points. Then when we went to the Championship, that was the first year it became the Championship. And we were still beating teams. So in the end, what happened was Wigan were always well known for being able to bring a great team together without having to spend so much money. So what I found was there was players leaving the club at times, having not been offered enough money to stay. And I was like, wow, you're going, okay, right, you're going, okay. And then I thought, okay, with me, surely they won't obviously treat me like that because I'm doing really well. I've been top scorer. Hopefully they wouldn't want to do that to me. But when I signed a 4-year contract or so. And I had it inside my contract, if we got promoted, that I would get a new renegotiation to my contract. So having played that first season and won the league, my shoulder actually came out the first few weeks in training from when I first arrived. So my agent, my manager told me, look, please play and then get your operation at the end of the season. So once that happened at the end of the season, I said, fine. We got promoted, and then what happened was they said that they will not give me a new contract. How can you negotiate for an injured player? So I was like, okay, no problem. What I'll do is I'll get fit, and then you can give me a new contract. And then the chairman said, no one's getting a new contract because it's a new league. No one knows if we're going to be able to stay in this league. So let's wait and see how we do. Then we'll give a new contract. So I was like, okay, no problem. I'll just prove myself in the championship now. And then they'll give me a new contract. So the contract didn't come. We just missed out on the playoffs by 1 point or so. And I was top scorer for the team again with like 25 goals that season. I was top scorer in the cup as well. I think me and Paul Scholes were joint top in the Carling Cup. And so for me, I was going into my last year of my contract. No, I go into this is my last 2 years, sorry, in that season when we got promoted. So Jason Roberts comes and he is on pretty much double my wages. No problem. I didn't mind that at all because he's a bigger player. He came from the Premiership. No problem. But me knowing that that season when I got top scorer in the Championship and we got promoted automatically to the Premiership, now it became a thing where, right, I'm in my last year. Let's get a nice contract now because now I haven't had a new contract for 2 years. Surely they're going to compensate me for the 2 years that I didn't actually have anything done. I still top scorer for them every year. I've been patient, not spoke about contracts. And then during that season, my shoulder actually, after that, during that championship season, my shoulder actually came out again mid-season. And I had to play with the sling on for the rest of the season and still ended up top scorer. But in the end, the chairman called me in his room and told me I was not good for the remainder of that season once I had that shoulder. I think he was trying to say that to me so I would maybe try and ask for less money in my contract. So anyway, I just wanted the contract sorted so we can get on with playing Chelsea in the first game of the season. And having Jason Roberts as a partner, really relishing playing in a Premiership with him. And basically, they offered me way less money than Jason was on in the Championship. And I knew what he would go on to if he went up to the Premiership. And I was like, seriously, you've got to really concentrate on, you know, thinking about what you've done over this time. And they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to offer me anything. My agents came up from London and the chairman was on holiday. So he arranged a meeting with my agents to actually negotiate a new deal. And he wasn't there and he was on holiday in Barbados, and he actually wasn't available to speak on the phone to actually okay any negotiations. So my agents had to go back to London and rearrange another appointment to come again. They came again 2 weeks later and he was still not there again. He was still away. So we couldn't actually negotiate a new deal. And they were telling me that I would be the highest paid player. And I said, look, you know, not being funny, but I've seen Jason Roberts' contract. I know he's on more. So that's definitely not the case. But anyway, you know, just please just think about it and just please, you know, just give me a deal that I'll be happy with. They didn't want to do that. And then what happened was Brian Robson, he called and he said that he's interested. And me being a Man United supporter since I was 5, I was a bit excited. I thought, okay, he's at West Brom. West Brom have just got promoted. They just avoided relegation. And they've got some big players there. So the way I looked at it was, right, I want a contract. I need a contract. My wife's pregnant. And I don't want to go into my last year having no contract. And it's in the Premiership season where the manager's just brought a new striker in. He may not play me. He may just buy some experience. I might be on the bench sitting there, or I might pick up an injury. So I didn't want that to happen. My agent said, look, what I would do is just not sign anything. Let the season play out and see what happens. You'll be on a Bosman at the end of the season and you'll decide to do what you do from there. I didn't want to do that. So I decided to go to West Brom because it, the worst case scenario I saw was that it was a sideways movement because I knew how good Wigan were. I said, the worst case is it's a sideways movement. I can try and, you know, kick on from there. And the way it ended was really, really sad because, you know, I went into the to the training ground. I was actually crying, saying bye to all the guys, you know, to everyone, because the manager knew I didn't want to go. Everyone knew I didn't want to go. And they just wasn't dealing with me correctly. And I started driving back towards West Brom and they called me on the phone and they actually offered me what I would have taken. And even though it was more money at West Brom, still, I would have even still taken it. But then it was now the principle of they just didn't deal with me correctly. I've given my word that I'm going to West Brom. And I said, I got to stick to my word now. Now, if I had that time again, I wouldn't be sticking to words because that's not what gets you far in football. What gets you far in football is the correct decisions, no matter what your emotions are. But yeah, at that time, I made that decision. I didn't listen to the agents that I actually, you know, employed to tell me the right things to do. And I basically, I think it was a worse decision, wasn't it, in the end? But considering the circumstances and the way it was, I don't know if I would have been able to do anything other than what I've done. So
let's dig into that. So why was it a bad decision?
The reason why it wasn't the right decision was more to do with I had everything and I know how it is to have a team that fits the way you play, like a glove. That's number one. Number two was I wasn't played. So I wasn't played enough when I went to West Brom. I played half the games of the season. And I told the manager at the end of the season, I felt like you bought me to make it hard for Wigan to stay up rather than buying me to play. I felt like that's what would may have been their strategy. And obviously it turned out at the end that it was not the best of decisions because of that. We got relegated. Wigan stayed up and did really well. They was top half of the table, playing some great football, you know, getting quite far, beating, you know, some big teams. So in the end, you're looking back and going, man, I wish I'd stayed, even though all of this has happened. You know, they're the main things that happen. And you're like, look, I was settled where I was. I knew everybody. I was the main guy. I was playing every week. You know, everything was in the right spot at Wigan. And I would have loved to have played with Jason Roberts in the Premiership because we knew we could hurt anyone because we had, between the two of us, we had the tools to unlock anything. So anyone who is big, I could beat them in the air. Anyone who's quick, he can beat them for pace. Anyone who's strong, we're both strong. I've got a left foot and right foot. So we had everything that to be able to unlock any defence. And, you know, it's just really disappointing that it didn't get to play out. But that's life sometimes.
That's really interesting. And do you think that it affected you at West Brom? Did it affect where you could have possibly have gone to? Because I know you didn't stay at West Brom for very long.
Well, knowing certain things that happened, I know the following season, I was very close to getting into the England squad. My agent, actually, at the time, he says he just came off a call with one of the guys who scouts for England. And you were that close. They came down to watch me at a game at West Brom, but I wasn't playing. But that game, if I was playing, I would have got called up to the England squad. Knowing that, that was like, you know, a bit painful. You know, knowing that, you know, after a while, just finding that out, it's like, oh my gosh, I was that close. I knew, I felt I was really good and I could do really well for anyone. And my agent always says, you know what, you should be playing for England. You know, the type of football you are and the type of things you can do, you should play for England. You should be able to. You will get there. But it was a case of I go there and, you know, I go to West Brom and just not playing regularly enough. And it's just not enough. It's not enough to push on to the next level. And that's really what went wrong there. Not enough to push on to the next level. Then we get relegated. Then they don't let me go back to Wigan at the end of that season because the manager wants me. And then I end up staying in a Championship My head goals at that point, I really wanted to get going. And then this following season, I think it's the following halfway through the season, you know, Portugal came in again for me. And they were just stalling, not allowing me to go. Then eventually allowing me to go, at which point the club had brought in a player from Nigeria, Julius Agahawa, and they're waiting on his permit. So they pulled out the whole month, that transfer month, knowing that they were going to let me go at the end of it. But Portugal couldn't take that chance. And at the time, I rang him to say, look, they will let me go now. Imagine I'm waiting all day, every day, every day I came in the training ground, I knock on the chairman's door saying, listen, come on, let me go now. And then he eventually says, yeah, call Portugal, you can go. I call him and he says that to me. We've got Julius Agahawa. And if this permit comes through, sorry, not much I can do. So an inch away from going back to the Premiership, and then it's taken away by an accepted work permit. So it's tough. It's tough. But
So now with this going on the field, what's going on off the field?
Well, to be fair, the season that we got promoted with Wigan to the Premiership, that was the year that I actually became a Muslim. So I found out about religion. I found religion. I did a bit of research and I came to the conclusion that Islam was the religion that I wanted to follow. And that's what I decided to do. So for me, it was a case of nothing changed at that time. Nothing really changed at the time I actually became a Muslim because I didn't know much information. But as I learned more, obviously I got more and more kind of excited and wondered why I'd never known this information for 21 years of my life, really. But at the same time, it didn't change anything on the pitch, you know. But again, what you have is the world's perception of Muslims at the time, which I was really oblivious to, you know, about the 9/11, which happened and stuff like that. I didn't realize that it was, you know, I didn't put two and two together at the time. So, you know, me, I was just going on with my days playing football, but then finding out about this beautiful religion and everything about it, I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable. So I didn't realize it would have a negative effect on my career. I think a lot of people obviously saw things in a bad light, you know, like Muslims in a bad light, when really you shouldn't see a religion in a bad light. You should see people are bad in every religion. People are bad when they don't have a religion. So that's something that really got, I got connected to, I guess. It was a bit of a negative stigma attached. He's not interested in his football as much anymore. He's too interested in other stuff. And it's annoying because when somebody says something about you in football, it usually then sticks, even if it's not true. So, you know, it's weird because I was playing football, playing some of the best football of my time, of my life. And then to hear someone saying he's not interested in his football, I'm like, but what do you do in your spare time? Everyone does their own thing in their spare time anyway. Like when I go to football, I love football. I play football exactly the same all the time. The only difference was when I became more knowledgeable, I started obviously praying I started praying further down the line and maybe I'd have a beard a bit longer, stuff like that. But again, it became a negative for some reason. And, you know, football is, you know, they're not really, what's the word? It's not accepting, but it's more they're not really, what's the word? That, you know, they've got a culture. They've got a culture in football. And obviously, if it's not the football culture, you're obviously seen as a little bit different. And that's probably what it is. So I could go on a team bus with a Quran in my hand, maybe trying to read a bit. And there could be others sitting on the coach playing, you know, cards for money. But the cards for money would be normal. And I'd be seen as not interested in playing my career because I'm reading a book about religion. So they're the kind of things that really became a challenge at the beginning.
But how did that, again, affect you? But I know it was tough and it kind of takes a lot to kind of motivate yourself, particularly if you've been in a team that's been relegated, particularly as you touched on, you've converted to a religion and you feel that that has hampered your career. And clearly you became maybe a bit of a journeyman, just trying to find the right club, the right atmosphere to get the best out of yourself. But whilst doing that, how did it feel? Like, how did you overcome it? So how do you go on?
You know, when you play football, even from a young age, I think my generation, we were used to getting shouted at. We were used to being able to deal with people telling you you're not good enough at certain things. You're used to not playing. So I don't think it affected me like it affects people today. I think it's a lot different now. You get brought up in schools to never really even, you know, you got sports day and nobody wins sports day anymore. And, you know, you don't get winners and second and place and all of that. And I think it makes a difference to your character when you get older. And for me, I was able to handle that, you know, not playing a lot of times, not playing and all these things. I'm handling it because I know how good I am. I know what I can do. But again, it does take its toll. It does take its toll, but it's just a case of you got to have that different thing about you. When to become a pro, you've got to have that extra little bit of confidence, that a little bit of arrogance when it comes to football. Like, look, I'm the man, I can do whatever. I'm the best player on the pitch and all that kind of stuff. That's what you got to have. Otherwise, you go onto the pitch and you start thinking negatively, you'll never be the you that you can be anyway. So it did start happening towards the end of my career, I'd say. I knew it was affecting me mentally at times, because then if you get a manager that is shouting at you every time you make a mistake or something, what happens is you end up thinking, I don't want to lose this ball. You go on the pitch going, I want to make sure that the next ball gets to a teammate. I don't want to lose the ball. Rather than, I'm going to destroy this player. I'm going to turn him. I'm going to whip this. It's such a different thing. Like, you've got to have that mindset. And that's why you have players, you know, when you see that, you sometimes you think, how can a player go from being so good to so bad? And it is a lot to do with mentally. Because if you've got the right manager on your side, you can be sometimes even double the player. So that's the way it is. And for me, it was a case of trying to be as strong as possible. And actually, there's actually one more thing I want to mention. The season that we actually got promoted to the Premiership, me and Jason actually said that he gets this lady called Marissa Pia to hypnotize him. So he said, I'll get her to come down to the hotel and she can hypnotize whoever wants it done. So I got hypnotized that season. He got hypnotized that season. Funnily enough, end up being top scorer in the league, and we end up winning, getting promoted automatically. So that's a mindset thing that I really felt, wow. And all she really does is get you to kind of control your mind and get you to think about good things that you've done, or think about good players, and then think about your them, picture yourself as them and picture yourself scoring that goal, picture yourself. It's just like, believe it, you can achieve it kind of thing. And it actually happens and it actually works. So what I started doing from this point was, I would, before every game, I would have a recording of all my goals. I'd watch them. I'd also have a list of things that I need to do. So start quick, you know, make sure you warm up so much that you've got your second wind in the warm up. Most people, they go through the paces in the warm up. Then their legs are, you know, their legs are kind of full of blood at the first few minutes, and then they have to get their second wind. But with what I've decided to do was, I need to get really fit. And if I'm on the bench, I need to really, really, you know, like warm up like crazy. So then I'm ready straight as soon as I go on. And so there's made all these little things that I would always remember to do to give myself the best chance to play well in a game as well.
So you're
that's
touching
a lot
on,
of mental stuff.
You're touching on the kind of intensity that, you know, these coaches want to see. But just to go back or touch on a point here. So you said, of course, you had this expensive house, you wanted to sell it. And I just wanted you to talk about how that happened?
Obviously, buying a house on something you may do in the future was the first mistake and decision I made that led to what happened down the line. And I bought a number of properties throughout my career, thinking, you know, my mum would always make sure I've got a portfolio of properties. So when I finished playing, I'd have, you know, lots of buy-to-lets, people renting out, and I'd be able to live off a nice kind of income from something built while I was playing. But with the crash that happened, all the properties being how they were, and another thing religious-wise, I wasn't allowed, I'm not allowed to deal with interest. So it was something that I straight away, I said, look, I don't want to have any of these properties anymore because they're buy-to-lets, they're interest only completely. So I wanted to eradicate that from my finances completely. But not only that, that all the properties were worth pretty much less than what they were worth, what they were bought for. So time was running out. My career was going towards this end. Obviously, income was running down. Lower wages every team at a lower level. And in the end, I end up coming back from Ipswich, having stopped playing at Ipswich and coming back and having no club, but I'm back in my big house in Wilmslow. So I have a few years left, and obviously I know I'm not going to be able to pay for it. I had people renting it for a while. People were renting my house, but no one ever wanted to buy it. So in the end, I had to give the house back. The bank said, look, you can't pay the payments anymore once my contract was up. And obviously I had my family and I had a little bit of money spare. And I said to myself, right, what am I going to do from here? And it was a case of having to go bankrupt. And it was voluntary bankruptcy, so you just obviously say you can't pay and they just basically seize everything that you have. And I ended up just having to think about, right, my career is up now. I've got another, I don't know how many, I've got probably enough money to last me a little while. And I've got to now think of what I'm going to do now. What's the new industry I'm going to get involved in? This was the major struggle after that, because it's like starting with no experience in anything and needing to have an income of a high amount to be able to sustain what I've had in the past. Because the minute your contract finishes, straight away, the day that finishes, that's the day your last contract gets paid, your last wage gets paid. So it was just living off savings and trying to build something. So that's where the struggle came. And it was all about, from that day, it was, you know, I found a few companies or a few schemes that I thought would be good and thought, you know, get rich quick schemes, you'd probably call them in the end. And, you know, I tried and failed in many different things, knowing that I had my family to feed as well and time was running out, money was running out. It became a thing where, you know, it was very, very difficult to come to terms with, because when you get bankruptcy and if you got a car, I had two cars paid for, I had my own apartment paid for. So I had the major things already sorted. But what happened was once you go bankrupt, you can't have that anymore. So I had to give my cars away and they had to take the money from that. And I ended up with, I think I remember having a Mini at the time. Even the Mini was worth more than what they would allow me to have. So they took more money. I had to pay a fine for that as well. So things got really tough. And it was just a case of restarting from that point.
You're the Duke, you're a successful footballer, and you go from earning a lot of money a week to zero, and also having to then deal with a bankruptcy, having to feed and clothe your kids and your family. How did you come out of that?
I think my religion made me put everything into perspective, because I came from having not much anyway. Then I had a lot. Then I went back to having not much. So it's not anything that I've not been able to deal with in my life before. So that was something that I was able to handle. But at the same time, people obviously see me as you know, a legend at certain clubs, and you know, see me as someone who's achieved so much, and to obviously, to if they were to see me back down again, kind of, it would obviously, it's not a great thing anyway. But secondly, it was a thing of, look, do you want to stay like this, or do you want to, you know, do something to get back? How can you get back? What can you do to get back? And that was the thing that I had to sit there and just really contemplate what I can do. And again, business is a total different area, and it was loads of trial and error over the last so many years now, trying to figure out what to do. And my mindset was really like this: you've done it before in football, you knew what you had to do to get there, and so you've got to apply that same energy, that same work rate, where you don't see any of the results, any of the fruits for years maybe, but then in the end you may see the fruits. So that was my thing. It was like, look, whatever you find, you've got to have a passion for it, and you've got to work hard, and you're going to keep working hard. And you know, I ended up working a few jobs for my friend's shop, another friend of mine, solicitor firm. I've worked at a few places, and I ended up doing that just to get by, at the same time always trying to build something on the side, because I knew that was what will set me free again. Not just working isn't going to set me free. If I'm going to, you know, if I wanted to be satisfied with just living a normal life, that's fine. You can go about your life that way, and that's not a problem. But for me, I already, you know, felt a certain way of life, and I know what kind of life I want to work towards. So it was just a case of knowing that I have to sacrifice a lot. Maybe, you know, a few years where I don't get to do things with my family. I don't get to, you know, spend good times, you know, through doing things, because I've got to focus, laser focus on certain things until it gets to where I want it to get to. So that was the tough part. It's been work in progress, but I'm now starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and things are, you know, really starting to pick up after quite a few years of trial and error. It's never over till you decide it's over. So you've got the whistle. It's like you're on the pitch and the referee's going to blow the final whistle. It's not getting blown until you decide yourself. So you're never down until you decide.
So Nathan, I just want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing this amazing story. And I hope it goes on to inspire others that are listening to this. It's always possible to have to get out of a situation, as long as you have the right mindset, keep believing, keep being focused, just as Nathan has told us today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the podcast, and it's been really enjoyable as well, to be honest. And I hope many people can benefit from the lessons I've learned and take it into their life as well.
Thank you, Darren, and thank you so much, Nathan. A fantastic, inspiring story. We hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. If you have been inspired by Nathan's story, please go to rollingstart.org.uk for more information. On the next episode, we'll be speaking to Natalie Fay, the founder of City to See.